More about them. My email is thepephouse30minutes, MINS, at KBOO.org. And you can catch me next Sunday, same time, 30 minutes. And we're just going to explore what we have in the city of Portland, down in Salem, and all over the places. But I'm going to let you hear this last song again from Stained. It's called Stained from Named Entertained. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO's zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local businesses, on-the-ground reporting, and fun quizzes and crosswords. Our zine has its finger on the pulse of Portland, and you don't want to miss it. To snag your copy, visit kboo.fm/zine.
Hello, I'm your host, Donald Altman, and welcome to Pathways, where you're invited to join us for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. The mystery of UFOs has been with us for thousands of years. Even the Buddha was said to have commented that there were otherworldly beings on the planet, but that no one with a human consciousness could communicate with them. There's a lot of research and books devoted to the UFO phenomena, but very little has been written about the individuals who claim having seen UFOs and having had contact with aliens. And what does this fascination with UFOs and aliens say about us as humanity? Are aliens invaders from outer space as imagined in Hollywood? Are they the byproduct of psychological, sociological, and cultural factors? Are they non-terrestrial intelligences who are closely linked to humanity? To help explore these questions and more is Nigel Watson. Nigel has researched and investigated historical and contemporary reports of UFO sightings since the 1970s. He writes a monthly column, Saucers of the Damned, about UFOs for 14 times and has regularly contributed to Fate, Flying Saucer Review, The Unexplained, Paranormal Magazine, UFO Magazine, Outer Limits Magazine, and many, many others. He also contributed to the Dark Lore Anthology series and to several books edited by the late Timothy Green Beckley. He has also written in detail about the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. In his new book, Portrait of Alien Encounters Revisited, Nigel speaks directly with ordinary people in the United Kingdom who have reported seeing UFOs and a wide range of starling-associated phenomena. Now, in the past, these were considered by UFO investigators as far-fetched or crazy. Well, we may get a different picture here today. Nigel has a degree in film and literature from the University of Warwick and a degree in psychology from Open University. And Nigel lives in Plymouth, United Kingdom. It's an honor and a pleasure to have Nigel Watson here with us today. Hello, Nigel, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hello, glad to be here.
You know, I'm curious about your own personal journey. How was it that you got interested in investigating UFOs as far back as the 1970s?
Yeah, well, it was an easy downward spiral, really. But I started off by being interested in the moon landing missions in the late 60s. And, you know, the headlines in the paper were about the Apollo mission mainly and the race to the moon, because obviously the Americans were in a race with the Soviets to land the first man on the moon. So it was an exciting time for anyone interested in space exploration. And, you know, it just I just found it fascinating that we could, you know, travel beyond our own planet and go somewhere else.
Well, was that the beginning of was there an upsurge in reports of UFOs as a result of that exploration and the moon landing?
Yeah, I think there was. In the mid-60s, particularly in Warminster, there was a big wave of sightings, and it became a kind of a hot spot in the UK for UFO sightings. And that was like really dead in the middle of all this Cold War space race. And I think there was a wave of sightings in 1967 throughout Britain, and that caused quite a bit of controversy. So, but I don't think people were really equating it too much with the space missions, and I was a bit young to follow that, really, and it wasn't until something like 1969 or 70 I actually come across some UFO books in the local library, and that's what gained my interest, really. But we're fairly rubbishy books, really, in that one or two of them were like contactee books who said that, you know, by these contactees in America of the 1950s,
yeah,
said they'd actually met humanoid aliens and had rides on their spaceships. So
yeah,
there was these sensational stories that I think everyone took with a pinch of salt. And then there were more serious books that kind of books recommended by NICAP and, you know, civilian organizations that were interested in the sort of scientific study of UFOs. But even then, in sort of 1970, these books were fairly old, and they did have references to UFO magazines, you know, they had addresses in. So I started getting Flying Saucer Review, which was an internationally renowned magazine produced in Britain, but it had lots of foreign cases from America and South America, Europe and the Soviet Union. So it was a really good magazine at that time, and then
yeah,
that led me on to other magazines as well. So I suppose in those days you didn't have like Google to troll through all the news stories. And
right, books. Yeah. Yeah, I can remember back, I don't know what year it was, but Whitley Strieber wrote his book about his abductions.
Oh, yeah.
And I happened to be in a bookstore at the time when he was appearing. I wasn't there to see him, but there was a line out the door. I remember that.
Right.
I mean, and I did listen to what he had to say. It was fascinating. And so I can see how this is very captivating, hearing these stories of people. And in your book, I found it to be very unique from the typical UFO type book. I mean, your case histories are fascinating, but you've explored the UFO experience and the who you call percipients, the people who are experiencing
yeah, yeah,
it. And it's interesting some of the similarities you've uncovered here. What are some of the features of the UFO percipient that you've found or identified?
Yeah, I think there are quite a few similarities. What I was surprised to find, a lot of them seem to be influenced by the Christian Bible, and that the Book of Revelations seemed to dwell heavily on a few of these people I interviewed. And that, you know, was particularly the book of Revelation, where the apocalypse is coming. And, you know, so people did interpret UFOs as perhaps being a danger or warning to humanity. And so the Bible seemed important in that sense. And then a few of the people who perhaps weren't even influenced directly by the Bible did see angelic beings in conjunction with, you know, the UFO and paranormal experiences. And I think that's another running theme, in that when you speak to people who have had really strange UFO encounters or communications, they often have a kind of history of having paranormal events and coincidences and poltergeist activity surround them, of a family and friends. And often this sort of phenomenon can seem to run through families. And,
yeah, now that's really interesting, that actually throughout certain families you find this prevalence in recognizing or identifying or connecting with UFO experience.
Yeah, there's a couple of people there who say, of a father or a grandfather said, oh, the dad missing time, or had seen something strange or had a ghostly encounter. But often people don't really talk about it, so it will only come up if somebody, you know, talks about their UFO sighting. I think another thing you seem to get is a kind of trigger event. Like for me, the moon mission sort of triggered me on to explore the UFO subject. But in terms of a UFO experiencer, they might see a light in the sky, or perhaps a landing of a UFO, or see alien entities. And that kind of triggers them to remember that they'd had similar encounters in the past, but had sort of dismissed or forgotten about them. And they also might remember childhood encounters of balls of light, or meeting strange entities. You know, that's the thing, though, that there's some sort of event that usually triggers somebody to then often look at books the same way I did.
Yeah.
Because I want to discover more about the subject.
Is there a proneness to fantasy, to appreciation or a greater interest in fantasy for people that may have experiences?
Yeah, the interesting thing is, if you ask these people, they normally say they're not interested in fantasy or science fiction, and that, you know, a lot of these people you talk to seem to be quite down to earth and not really fantasy prone, as some skeptics would say. I think, though, these people are usually quite creative, and they do have an imagination. It's not something they really use in their everyday lives. So you could say they're channeling any creativity or imagination through the scope of UFO sightings, and that people use messages from aliens to give a certain amount of authority to these messages. And these messages are often the kind of things they'd like to promote, like vegetarianism, or, you know, world peace, or, you know, to stop atomic warfare and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's what I found interesting, was how some of the people in your book felt they had an important message to share with humanity, something of value, to something to help us on our way.
Yeah.
And that the aliens were maybe also trying to help us, that they were not necessarily evil forces. Is that what you found?
Yeah, because they can be very frightening as well, but there seems to be the good side to it as well. I think a couple of people in the book are sort of like, feel like they're in the center of a cosmic battle between good and bad forces. And often the bad aliens are usually the kind of reptoid or insectoid type aliens, whereas the good guys tend to be humanoid Nordics.
Well, you know what's so interesting? I mean, we have a reptilian part of our brain, which is a part of the brain that can be stimulated into fear and is more maybe not as evolutionarily evolved as the frontal thinking part of our brain. And so it's interesting that they would see the reptilian as this kind of dangerous force.
Yes, I think the aliens take on the kind of shape people expect. So they're products of nightmares, or of not so much nightmares, but also of fantasies about helpful aliens as well. You know, like an ET, they save an alien who's who's ecologically friendly. And I think, you know, there's also people in my book who have good messages from good aliens who seem to radiate light and are almost like guardian angels that either are there to protect the individual or feel protective towards the human species at large. But often the messages are very much like the contactee messages of the 1950s, except they're not shaped in the form of actually meeting humanoids and having rides on their spaceships. I think that's another thing about a lot of the people I interviewed. A lot of their stories are quite fragmented, and so I've collected the stories together to give a kind of timeline to what they told me about. And I think I've tried not to censor or edit it, because I think some people could use the sort of stories I've received to shape it into a sort of exciting story about encountering space people and having a narrative that's sort of entertaining. But I wanted to keep it more grounded in what the people actually told me. So, and I didn't really want to censor anything out either. I had a bit of criticism, probably would still get criticism for including cases that don't belong to ufology. We'll just say, oh, that's just childhood fantasy, or that's somebody who's depressed or whatever. But I think you've still got to wonder why those fantasies are shaped by the UFO narrative. Are they just dipping into UFO books and using that data to tell their own fantasy, or to relate to their own depression or excitement about meeting these things? But I think none of the people I spoke to really had a massive agenda to try and prove anything either. They kind of simply told me their stories, and I think I tried to keep neutral about these things. I didn't really discuss other cases or what my ideas were, but I suppose I might have thought I was a bit negative rather than that supportive. And in a way, it is difficult really, because if you're too supportive and enthusiastic, you might be just encouraging these people to have, more stories to impress the investigator rather than real fact. I think that's happened in poltergeist cases, and I think it's particularly true of Bud Hopkins and his alien abduction support groups, where people met, and it was a good therapeutic idea, but it also meant some people wanted to tell better stories from the other person to get Bud Hopkins' attention. And I think, that is a problem, where your very presence could be encouraging somebody's behavior. And if I suppose that's not too bad if it's not negative or anything, but I think sometimes I felt that I needed help and support myself, because some of these people have really intense experiences, and you think, perhaps, they might not be aliens, or might be, that we're going through psychological trauma. And so in a way, you don't really want to sort of pile agony onto them by promoting these sort of ideas when they're having a negative impact.
Yeah, I think that came through in your book too, that you had an impartial stance toward the people you were interviewing. There were a lot of references in the book, and I thought you did a nice job of letting people share their stories. And it's really important. You've been studying this phenomena for decades. Have you noticed a difference in how UFO sightings have altered over time or evolved? And what does that say about our own relationship to the unknown?
Well, it's interesting because alien spaceships, or even the beings themselves, they would seem to be one step of ahead of our own technology. So I think even like 1990s, people in the UK and Belgium were seeing these triangular UFOs, and we were seen in the Midlands and different parts of Europe. And some people thought they were like stealth technology, that there might have actually been United States aircraft being tested on U over UK territory. Although, it seems a bit audacious for them to test secret aircraft, on a different foreign territory, really. And there again, in the early 2000s, there were lots of fleets of orange globes floating about, which mainly were attributed to Chinese lanterns. So these things go through phases, and with the United States Navy aircraft filming tic-tac UAPs and things, people are more apt to say they've seen a tic-tac than a flying saucer. So the shape and description changes. And also, like nowadays, we've got UAPs, and these seem to be more related to almost like drone-like craft, that the craft that don't seem to have any means of propulsion, and that can operate at high speed and can go into the ocean. And then mixed in with all these sightings of drones that people think could either be, secret drones being operated by military or civilian pranksters, or foreign agents, or non-human intelligences. So you've kind of got a sort of mega mix of different things, really. With new technology, you get new a kind of new mystery surrounding them. And it was the same back in 1909 and 1913. British people were seeing phantom airships that they attributed to German zeppelins flying over Britain. So there again, it was a fear of a new technological leap that would totally change the shape of warfare and potentially invasion, because airships would neutralize the powerful naval defenses we had. Whereas now, drones have been shown to be effective in warfare, but were also shown to be something that can be very elusive and could be part of alien technology or something else. And so it's really difficult for an investigator to differentiate between all these things, because when I first started investigating, a lot of the sightings I got were of, lights in the sky or things at a distance. They can take a lot of investigating, really, with little reward, really, and often perhaps you could investigate it better if such things repeated themselves. But often, there could be, satellites, aircraft, weather balloons, all sorts of different things. And that's just when you're dealing with like low strangeness cases. So when you're dealing with high strangeness cases, you're going more into the realms of, I suppose, what you would call inner space. Have people being influenced by something outside.
Well, it's really interesting to see how technology has an infusion of new technology can create a wave of different kinds of sightings and whatnot. And other than technology, what other kind of things can spur these kinds of sightings?
Well, sometimes it can be just more down to earth fears. In the early 70s in Britain, there was a wave of phantom helicopter sightings, and people said the IRA were operating on the British mainland. So
political, political worries, instability can
danger,
create.
yeah. And then I think one or two people captured newspaper headlines saying that it was their helicopter or aircraft that created some of these sightings. And you often get people coming out of the woodwork to say, it was me that done it, just to get the publicity.
Well,
But
you
then it.
actually, yeah, I mean, you had somebody in your book come out. There was a series of leprechaun sightings, and it was a number of children, right, who were involved in this, and that created quite a stir, from what I understand from your book. Can you talk about that case and really a fascinating case of a group of people seeing something?
This occurred in the early 60s in Liverpool. It's probably got a bit more famous over the years, really. I don't think people took much notice of it back then. But basically, it started off with children saying there were leprechauns in a park in Liverpool, and it meant and they said that these like leprechauns were like throwing rocks or stones or something, and then the kids all sort of converged on the park and caused a lot of trouble. The police had to move them, and some of them said they'd seen leprechauns, but it was all a bit of almost like a panic, really. And then it went to some other parks in Liverpool. Then it went to Kirby, which is a nearby area near Liverpool, and that occurred, I think, in a churchyard. And you seem to get this a lot. There's another one in a scare, mainly by children, of them saying there was some sort of vampire in a churchyard. And it's interesting because some of them are these things seem to have been easily triggered. And if you look at old film footage, children used to play on the streets a lot more, so there was a lot of word of mouth then, rather than today, where they'd all be on WhatsApp or something. But in those days, they all and there was quite a lot of newspaper stories. And there again, a man said, this short man said he was responsible. An entertainer called Ken Dodd said it was him talking about Diddy Men had created it. So you got a few sort of mundane explanations, but early on there was quite a good newspaper reporter, somebody saying they'd seen, I think, a UFO and some sort of entity with it, and they said the leprechauns had come to Liverpool from Ireland on a flying saucer. So there was that neat connection between the old Irish
Old myths and
and obviously Liverpool has a large Irish population. So there's that sort of transfer. So it's quite neat that there was at least one UFO sighting connected up with that. And I think it's interesting as well that it generally involved children. And I've got quite a few stories of just individual children seeing things. So I think they're just more open to these things, because if somebody said, oh, there was a leprechaun in the local park, a lot of people would just think you're mad and go away. Whereas if another kid says, oh, there's leprechauns in the park, it's a big adventure, isn't it? And they all want to go and see what's going on.
Yeah.
So,
Well, it sounds like there's really a need for humans to experience things out of the ordinary or an altered consciousness, right?
I think even like when I was younger, just going down to the back garden, at night time seemed really frightening. There could be ghosts anywhere. And I think when you're really young, you see images in the curtains or lights under the bed, or that sort of thing. You're a bit more attuned to anything being a bit of a mystery or strange. You haven't got the experience to know, you're perfectly safe there. Hopefully you are anyway.
Well, I found your book to be very interesting, very fascinating. Portraits of Alien Encounters Revisited. Nigel, there's a lot we could talk about, and I'd love we if we had more time, but we've kind of run out here. So let's be sure to tell our listeners where they can find your book, and it can be found at Amazon, any of the online retailers. The book publishing website is collectiveinkbooks.com. Right. So that's where you can learn more about Portraits of Alien Encounters Revisited and more about Nigel and his work. For those who tune into the Pathway Show late, this is your host, Donald Altman, author of the award-winning spiritual adventure novel, Travelers. My Simply Mindful book series includes the new Simply Mindful Reflections, as well as Simply Mindful Resilience, Simply Mindful Meal by Meal, the Simply Mindful Coloring Book, and Simply Mindful, a 7-week course and personal handbook for mindful living. Information about my other books, courses, and CDs can be found at mindfulpractices.com. And that's MINDFUL practices.com. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we've been visiting with author Nigel Watson, a leader in the field of the UFO experience and UFO sightings. I want to say thank you to all our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO FM Sunday mornings at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com. And that's spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Donald Altman reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts. And thanks again to Nigel Watson and for writing this fascinating book, and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.
Dr. Demento, I am here in a land of happy, freaky people. KBOO Portland.
Are you ever listening to a new pop song or reminiscing over an old, well-loved album? And you catch a melody or a lick that reminds you of a different album altogether? Next thing you know, you're